Hello, my name is Gregory McKnight, and this is Positive Development, a conversation about real estate properties and how they were made, from where each project began through the many stages of the process, to understand the original vision and all that went into making it what it became, with the people who did it. The subject of the program today is San Vicente Bungalows, a private members club in West Hollywood with its owner, Jeff Klein. We will discuss the vision for the property, the space he built, how he did it, and what he discovered along the way. Hello, Jeff. Welcome. Tell us about yourself.
My name is Jeff Klein. I grew up in New York City on the Upper East Side. I graduated from Columbia Prep, went to Tulane University in New Orleans. I did my junior abroad in France, in Paris, France. I majored in French literature. And after I graduated, I went right away to work as a bellman for a hotel group that I admired in New York City, the Gotham Hospitality Group.
What was the hotel and who were the people?
The hotel was the Franklin Hotel, and the owner of the Gotham Hospitality Group was a man by the name of Bernard Goldberg. He and his CEO, Stephen Briganti, really became my mentors in the industry.
Well, how did that happen so fast, right from graduation?
Well, getting a job as a bellman's not that hard. It's not such a competitive market. It's not like, especially with a college education, they were like, you're hired.
What was the hotel? It was called the Franklin.
What happened was there was a man that I was particularly interested in named Bernard Goldberg. And he, in the early 90s, so I graduated in 1993, he was one of the pioneers of the boutique hotel industry. There was really only three people doing boutique hotels in America at the time. It was Ian Schrager, who, although I respect him tremendously, I wasn't interested in his kind of hotels. They were very trendy. And then there was this guy in San Francisco, Bill Kimpton, who owns the Kimpton Hotel Group. Now, he's since died, unfortunately. And then my boss, Mr. Goldberg. And so he owned these hotels in New York, and he'd buy them and he'd renovate them. And so I was interested in working for him. So I just needed to get in the door. Now it's a little different, actually. It's more competitive. But, you know, I worked my way up, and eventually he became my mentor and really taught me everything I know today.
So you wanted to work with him, and the opportunity was to be a bellman at one of his hotels. And so you went in and interviewed, and they gave you a job.
Yeah, not with him.
Of course.
The assistant front desk manager interviewed me.
How many properties did he have at the time, and why this one? And was it the one you'd already presumed you would try when you were older?
At the time, I think he had three properties. By the time I left, well, I didn't leave him. He sold his company, but he had the Franklin and the Wales, both were working on the Upper East Side. And I think he had just bought the Shoreham. So I was a bellman at the Franklin. Actually, they moved me between the two. And then eventually I got promoted to front desk agent, and then front desk manager, and then housekeeping manager, and then got into sales, and then I became the general manager. And then he sort of took note of me and taught me how to buy properties. He actually didn't buy properties. He was a brilliant man. He's still alive. He is a brilliant man. He would create these long leases because it was a way to finance the properties. So he would create these like 99-year leases and then raise some money for the renovation.
So how long was it till you entered the door as that first bellhop job to becoming essentially an acolyte and then someone who eventually supervised and trained?
I think it was about 4 or 5 years of moving up before he really took me under his wing. It was really him and this other guy named Stephen Briganti, who was his CEO. And Stephen, also a brilliant man. I was very lucky. I picked the right company. I was actually considering working for Bill Kimpton, moving to San Francisco, because I really liked his hotels more than I liked Mr. Goldberg's hotels. But, they say luck is everything. But so I was very lucky to get into his company because this man, Stephen Briganti, who had created his own major at Harvard in hotels and his... So it was like serious hotel geekdom, you know, like we all were really into it. And Stephen taught me just as much as Mr. Goldberg did. They were both my boss. And actually, ultimately, Stephen became my business partner in my first hotel project in New York City on 44th Street, which I'm still a partner in today, the City Club Hotel.
So 4 or 5 years into essentially putting yourself in their environment, working your way up, gathering trust, gathering experience, they take you under their wings and help you understand what it means to do what they do and assist them in their operations.
Absolutely. That's right.
Right. And so how long did you work for them and what did you do? And then you alluded to your own project with Stephen. When did that come up?
So I got about, another 2 years or so. I can look up the dates. I don't want to get it wrong and
Close enough.
It's close enough. And I mean, they were both very difficult bosses, but they were great in the sense that they really cared in investing in me and teaching me a lot. And so we then in 1999, Bernard sold his company. Stephen owned a piece of it. He'd given Stephen some equity. And Bernard sold it. And then Stephen and me and this guy who was one of Bernard's investors named John Zambetti, and his head of construction, this other guy, Russell, all found what was an office building and on 44th Street. And believe it or not, we also, like Bernard, structured this long-term lease, but we had an option to buy it, and we ended up buying it. So we renovated this building. It opened in 2001. It opened like on September 11th, 2001, which is a very difficult day to open a hotel. And
is that the actual day it did?
Yeah, I think it was like the 9th was the
Still
official.
A bad period.
It was a terrible, terrible period. Very scary. Not sure if we were going to go bankrupt. We raised money from like our families and friends, and it was really terrifying. But luckily, we pulled through, and that's a success.
So in 1999, when you bought this, or you acquired the lease and then eventually bought the property, mm-hmm. what was the area like at the time?
The Algonquin was next to it. I mean, it was it was sort of a classic area. It was filled with, ironically, private clubs, but university clubs. So like the Harvard Club is on that block and the Penn Club and the Royalton was across the street. It was already a pretty great block. And believe it or not, that building, it's like shocking to think about this. It's an entire hotel. We bought it for $9 million.
Wow.
And at the time we were like, that was our strike price, from the lease. The lease, I think, was like, I think it was like $700,000 a year or something. But we were like, God, that's just too expensive. We'll never buy it. And then, of course, you're able to buy it through a refi. Usually that's how these things work. But, today it's hard to, it's like a nice apartment would be $9 million.
Yeah. Incredible. What a time. So you initiated that City Club with your partners.
Right.
And ran it?
And ran it, yeah. I've always been this, the management. I'm an unusual, I'd say, in that sense, because I manage my own properties that are hotels. I'm really, I'd say, a hotelier first before I'm a developer. I know we're talking about development, but I'm like an accidental developer, quite frankly, because I never was interested in development, but I understood that it was a necessary part of my job. And I mean, it's interesting and I love it.
The development is a means to the hospitality.
That's right.
Yeah. Makes sense. Well, you ran the City Club then for a while. And then what happened?
I ran the City Club. And then 2003, I got a call about this building in Los Angeles that was for sale called the Argyle. And, I was like, I'm not that interested in LA. It's so far away. I'm a New Yorker. They kept on lowering the price and I looked at pictures of it and I thought it was interesting. And so I went and to look at it and I fell in love with it. And I thought it was a really interesting building, but my gut about the Argyle, is an Art Deco building, but it was meant, there was like a nightclub in the lobby and it was meant, they were trying to make it very trendy. And at the time, the Standard and the biggest sort of hotels, especially in that area.
Down the block.
And everybody who was looking at it was trying to figure out how to make it a hip hotel. And my vision for it was not to make it a hip hotel, but to make it sort of like a classic bring it back to its roots, and almost like a West Coast younger core version of the Carlyle, not as stuffy. And, you know, then you should make it hip. You should have a DJ in the lobby and, you know, all these things. And the Sky Bar was like the place at the time. And they're like, you need to reproduce that, figure out how to copy that. Copying's never a good idea in anything in life. But I said, no, I don't want the Sky Bar. I want the Tower Bar, which was always my vision of it. I was proven correct.
So you had an intuition about what to do with the space. Was it operational at the time? Or is it an apartment building, hotel? What was happening?
It was a hotel. So in 1929, when it was built, it was apartments. And it was called the Sunset Tower, which is why I brought it back to its original name. And it had an incredible rich history. All these great, Greta Garbo lived there and Marilyn Monroe lived there. I mean, I know everybody always says this about places in LA, but they really, we've photos of Nicky Hilton on his honeymoon with Elizabeth Taylor coming home from their honeymoon there. And Elvis, Peter Bogdanovich told me this great story about how when he was married to, Sybil Shepherd, Elvis came in the driveway with his Memphis Mafia, is that what they're called? And picked her up. She got a divorce from him the next day because I guess Peter was married to her. It just has all this great history. And then in the 70s, it really fell into disrepair. And it's an interesting building because Werner Klemperer, the actor from Hogan's Heroes, was living in the building, but there was like broken windows. It was a derelict building because what happened in the 70s was all of the hippie culture was on Sunset Boulevard. It was no longer sort of a chic place to live, and they were all smoking pot and doing whatever on Sunset, protesting. And so Werner Klemperer, who had by then run out of money, became a squatter, and he actually saved the building. I don't think he meant to, but he wouldn't leave. And the owner was trying to develop it by tearing it down, which would have been a real travesty. And because he wouldn't move out, by the time they evicted him, there were historical protection laws put in place so that the owner couldn't tear the building down. So I have pictures of the Sunset Tower from the early 80s with like a chain link fence around it with spray paint on it. It's crazy. And then in 1980, the St. James Club bought it and renovated it. And they spent a lot of money, $46 million, which in 1986 dollars, I mean, even today, that would be a lot of money to spend on that building. and they went bankrupt. And then this Taiwanese investor bought it, and he bought it for $18.5 million in like, I think it was like 99. And he couldn't make it work. And then we ended up buying it for $18.5 million as well. So.
With the same partners you were operating?
No, actually it was a completely different group. So my partners in New York didn't want to do anything in LA. And it was a different group and I had more equity in this one. And
understood. So down the street, there was the Mondrian, and there was the other direction, a chateau. And in the middle, there's a derelict building that you saw and had a vision for that was not what they were doing everywhere else.
It wasn't derelict at that time, but
it was
the Argyle.
And you said, I'm going to do something different that we haven't seen reflected in LA at the time.
That's right.
You had a partner that backed you, and together you picked it up and you did the work.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially, that's what happened.
Well, it sounds easy in retrospect because, of course, it's a very popular and well-known fixture of the Strip. But given what you've just said, it wasn't that way at the time. And there wasn't maybe the same vision from other people that you had.
That's correct. No, I mean, nobody. It was very hard getting investors and convincing people when I would describe the vision of it. But I think that's why it's successful, because it's unique, and I knew that building could handle it, and that's what I wanted to create there.
Well, you certainly did. And so from acquiring it to developing it to popularizing it, it became a fixture, as we said. What next?
Is the San Vicente Bungalows, which
great.
Is a collection of little bungalows on San Vicente Boulevard. Actually, I should go back to 2008 for that because this property was for sale. It's an interesting property. There's many bungalows on this site, and then it was a sole owner, and they were built for the railroad workers, building the railroads between Hollywood and Santa Monica. And this place had become a gay bathhouse, which was great for me because it was really under the radar screen. What happened in the time, as my career was changing, hotels became very hot and everybody wanted to buy a hotel. Every billionaire, every rich kid, it was no longer for people in the industry. It was like a trophy thing. And so little guys like me couldn't find deals anymore. So like, the City Club for $9 million or the Sun's Tower for $18.5 million. You just couldn't find that because big money was going after them and overpaying for everything. So it was hard for me to find properties. But this property, because it was so off the radar screen and it was so disgusting, and I can even say this as a gay man, it was just hard to see it because it was gross what was going on in there and not pretty, And I couldn't even bring bankers in there because it was nudist. It was guys having just sex out in the open, a lot of drugs. People were, it was a very odd thing. People were shooting up heroin and cooking meth, and which is weird because the neighborhood, on either side of it, or one bedroom is like, $2.3 million or something. So this property was for sale. And my partner in the Sun's Tower, who couldn't bear even like finishing the tour with me, was like, we're not buying this. Is just like, they couldn't see it. People couldn't see it. But I always saw it from the second. It's the same way at the Sun's Tower, the way I saw it. So cut to somebody else buys it and it's not a hotel person. And I knew that not that I wish failure upon anybody, but I just knew it was going to be very hard for him to make it work. And I kept on calling him and saying, will you sell it? This is the one that got away. And he bought it for like $9 million or $9.5 million. And then finally one day, I just would call him every 6 months. I'd put on my calendar, I'm going to call this, And because it's a great location, I always knew because those trees and everything weren't there. I know you were there today, but I just had this vision for it and as like an oasis in the middle of the city. And finally, one day I called him and he said, if you can come up with, I think it was like $3.5 million, I have a loan on this place and I haven't paid it in 6 months and they're going to, my credit's going to get affected. They're going to take over this whole property. And so I figured out a way to get that money and I ended up buying it. He later then got into a lawsuit with his partner who didn't want to sell it, who felt that was unfair that I was able to buy it, even though I saved them from personal bankruptcy and whatever. But so it took like 2 years to close. So it was in escrow for a while, that property.
From when to when?
I think it was 2011 to 2013, okay. If I had to guess.
Right. So you had a vision for a property, you chased it, you made a deal, took a few years to close.
There were some lawsuits.
It all sounds like development to me.
It's a lot of development. I wasn't really in the lawsuits. The lawsuits were between them, but I had to prove that the partner I bought it from was able to sell it to me. And it was unclear at the time. And he was ultimately, and we worked together. He was the majority owner, but and had the absolute right and whatnot. But the courts had to sort of like figure that out too.
All the while you're running Sunset Tower and growing it and it's doing great while you're pursuing this project as your next.
So I closed in 2013. Then I start working on the entitlements and draw up a plan for it, which is what it is today.
So walk us through it. What does it look like? What does it feel like?
Well, it's really two properties because there's one property on the east side of San Vicente Boulevard, which is a hotel that's open to the public. It's called 850, and it's like a small, it's like a really cool European sort of high-end bed and breakfast is the best way to describe it. It has real soul, this hotel. It's very, very cool. I love it. it's a very unusual, unique experience, especially in Los Angeles and in America. There's a hotel in Sweden, I think it is, called At Home, that people always compare it to, which is like 12 rooms, and it's like in an old, you know, home, because it's a historical bungalow on the street, which houses the front of the hotel, and then the back of the hotel is this modern structure that Mark Appleton designed, the architect, when I bought it. So it was the historical building with a parking lot behind it.
I see.
So I developed the parking lot into this 23-room
entry through the classic bungalow. Then you developed a new, right, how many rooms?
23.
23 rooms, yeah, behind that. Understood.
And then on the west side of the street is 8 or 9 bungalows that surround a large courtyard with a pool in the middle, and all these mature California pepper trees and Brazilian peppers and roses. And you know, there's just lots of, it feels like a sort of a garden oasis, I guess. I mean, you know, you were there. I don't know how else to describe it. But and each bungalow sort of serves a different purpose. So one bungalow is the dining room, and another bungalow is the screening room, and another bungalow is the bar, and another bungalow is a living room. There's lots of hangout spaces because it's a private club. So there's the pool house, you know, where you could take your laptop, or you could have a meeting or have a coffee. And then there's also 9 guest rooms. And that's run as a private membership club, is doing very well.
So when you had your vision, it was essentially for this part of the property, and you knew what you would do with that space and turn it into the club and the guest rooms you're describing.
So my real vision was for the private membership club. Mm-hmm. The hotel across the street was part of my entitlement process because the city didn't want to lose. I bought it all as one thing, so I don't know what I would have done with across the street. I suppose I could have made it into apartments, but I'm not really a residential guy.
So what's the basic proposition of the club?
Well, this is no longer development. This is more business now, but...
it's all one thing.
The club is, first of all, it's a very unique experience because in LA, there really aren't that many outdoor experiences. I mean, there's the Beverly Hills Hotel, which is this huge sort of institution. I don't know, we're supposed to be boycotting these or not. And then there's the Chateau Marmont, which has a garden experience. But other than that, on this side of town, I'd say there's really no other hospitality outdoor garden experiences. So I think it's unusual in that sense. And it's a very special garden because of all the trees and the flowers and the little sort of like nooks and crannies in the garden and the pool in the center. And so it's unusual in that sense. So the other places I described are all, none of them really feel like this. But the garden itself really serves as the heart of the property, as the centerpiece. All of the bungalows are off of the garden. So even, you know, the Beverly Hills Hotel, let's say, you have to sort of like walk to places, and there's no central sort of courtyard like this. And it is very conducive to a nice social environment, I'd say. So if you want privacy and you want to hang out in the living room, in the corner of the living room, you can get privacy. But if you want to sort of like run into people, and the crowd is, you know, there's a membership committee and there's a curated crowd and whatnot. But you could run into theoretically people you know, and it's a very social place in that sense. And my thinking for that was, well, I saw Soho House open in 2008 in West Hollywood, and I was just blown away by that business. So being in hospitality my whole life, I thought no one's going to join. Who cares about Soho House? But I couldn't have been more wrong. It was so popular. People loved it. They did so well. And I thought that I could create something different on a different level and in a different way. And we're all so connected right now that we're actually disconnected through social media and whatever. You text your friend or you look at what he or she's doing on Instagram and you feel like you know about their life, but you don't. And I think it's so important to get real time with people and talk to them and see their facial expressions and, you know, learn what's going on in their life. And hospitality historically has been a place for that, but I also feel like in a private membership club, you have this unique ability, if done correctly, And especially in LA, which is a very isolating town, because you have to drive everywhere, you could, you know, run into people you know and feel comfortable. It's not such a big deal if you were eating lunch alone, or, you know, nobody's going to, you know, or whatever, if you just sort of want to run into friends or like-minded people or whatnot. And so I think that's probably why we're seeing so many of these private membership clubs popping up all the time. Some are for women, some are for working only, some are for social. So, but they're, it's like a, it's creating communities, I guess, for people.
So you decided to provide a space and create a group so that people could build that community and connect to one another. And the development was a product of that.
That's right.
And you mentioned a little bit about the market. It sounds like it's been developing around you. There was a Soho House right as you were initiating this. And then there have been other clubs that have come up since.
Yes.
And I'm sure we'll see more in that trend. Do you feel like it's an ebb or?
No, I think we're going to see a lot more of it. The Arts Club is from London and Soho House is from London. And the, what's the women's club in West Hollywood?
The Wing.
The Wing is from New York. So my roots and my connections are to this community, which I think is, makes it different because, you know, I've been living here for 15 years. I'm married to somebody who is very deeply rooted in the community. And so I think that makes a big difference as well.
Because it reflects your understanding of the actual place. It isn't just some abstract invention applied here.
Right. Like it's not just some, you know, recipe that was created for New York or London or wherever that's slapped onto an LA location. It's a very authentic location with, you know, authentic connections and to the community and, yeah.
And the space being outdoors, a key.
That's right.
And probably, since it's a membership club, the people you choose or your committee chooses and curates is probably a pretty substantial part of that.
Very much so. Very much so.
So did the idea evolve much from the initial spark, or was it sort of fully blown and you just had to execute it?
It was pretty fully blown. It, you know, that was from 2013. So it actually looks a lot like that with the sketches and the vision of the place is very similar to the original vision.
So once you got this gentleman to sell you the property and you worked on the entitlements and you got rid of the legal issue that was inhibiting the full transfer.
Yeah.
What next? It was architect, it was designer, it was...
Yeah, well, we hit a little bit of a snag in the development. You know, there are these like trolls that sort of look for, I think it was called a negative declaration.
Of a CEQA.
That's right. And so he was arguing you need to get a EIR for these, which we didn't. And we could have waited 2 years and fought him or, you know, pay him off. And we ended up settling it with him.
So he wanted a negative declaration. He wanted to be paid for.
No, we had the negative debt.
You had it.
And he claimed he wanted an EIR. He wasn't even local. He was just like a, you know.
So you dealt with that.
Dealt with that, which was upsetting. And
then finally, architect?
Well, the architect was the architect process. Was immediate.
Like
once, even while we were wrestling for it in 2011, we hired the architect and started designing so that it could be ready for, you know, when we bought it.
So when you got past all the legal issues, then you began construction or rehabilitation or what?
It was an unusual entitlement. It was entitled as an urban inn in the city of West Hollywood, and I think it was the first urban inn the city of West Hollywood had. So to keep those rights, because it was originally residential, and the city very much does not like taking apartments out of their residential pool. So I had to keep on running it. I stopped it. It was no longer a clothing optional all-male place, but I just made it like a regular hotel as I was getting all my entitlements. And getting all the architectural plans ready.
What was that like, operating a regular hotel, having done these more dramatic?
It was hard because it was like, you know, $99 a night or $129. It was very no frills. And
just had to keep it going for...
I just had to keep it going and try not to lose money, which I didn't, thankfully. But we finally closed it down when we were ready. There was a lot of financing problems. I was looking into EB-5 and, you know, it was very hard to finance. People And Soho House, for the most part, doesn't really own their properties. They lease them, so they don't have to, you know, get a lender. Although I think they own Miami and maybe one or two others, but people to pay $4,000 a year to be a member. And there was no convincing them.
Right. Well, that sounds relatively normal for a banker. So you had the money to get the property, and then you needed the construction funds to develop it.
That's right.
And after you went to the normal banking sources and hit the frustration you describe, what did you do?
Well, I ended up, it's funny, I just had lunch with the man. So this guy named Matt Schwab, who works for Carlin Real Estate, I showed him the property. It was like through a connection, this guy, Joe Self, who I know, who used to work at Carlin, was like, you should meet Matt, because I was sort of talking to people about how hard it was. And Matt saw it and in like 2 minutes was like, I'm going to lend you the money. And he did, and it worked out great for him. That's how I got financed. He just understood it. I mean, you really had to have a vision, and he's a really smart guy, and he did understand that.
So he gave you a loan to do the kind of work you needed to do. How long did it take to do the work?
It took about 20 months, 22 months, supposed to be 14.
Well, still pretty fast considering. And you had already done planning and design work through the many years prior while you were dealing with entitlements, building the 850,
That's right.
Getting through the legal issues.
That's right.
So as soon as you got bankrolled, you were ready to rock.
That's right.
So when were you operational?
We opened, I mean, technically we opened in December.
Of last year.
Yeah. But it was really January of this year. I mean, it was like a couple trial runs in December, but it was really January.
And so what was it like to open, considering all those issues we described? It's except for Soho House, there weren't so many social clubs.
It was...
I mean, the others you mentioned are relatively new.
Yeah.
And you needed some kind of membership to stock the pond, as well as to pay membership fees.
Right. I was lucky because of the Sunset Tower and the Tower Bar, and I'd say my, you know, sort of ties to the community and the clientele that I wanted to join. It was somewhat easy. Also, the committee, you know, so there were original members that we invited, and I was shocked at how many people joined without seeing it. I was actually joking. Because, you know, it's $1,800 initiation fee, and then it's $4,200. So one time, $1,800 initiation fee, and then it's $4,200 a year thereafter. So your first year is $6,000, and then every year thereafter is $4,200. If you're over 35, if you're under 35, it's a lot less. It's $1,800 a year and $500 initiation fee, one-time fee. But I was joking, so many people joined because they trusted, I guess, me. And you know, LA has such a lack of great places, sophisticated places especially. I should just sell the San Vicente and like open up a little basement and tell people this is what they paid for because, you know, we had all this money. So, but I obviously was teasing. I would never do that. That part was easy. But to your point, your question, what was so difficult? It's always something new in business. So, the stress was in 2011 to 2013, the stress was actually wrestling the tiger to the ground and getting the property. 2013 to 2016, it was entitlements. And then 2016 to 17, it was getting financing. Then finally you get the financing. Then the stress is, you know, construction and you're going over budget and taking too long. And then the stress is, fortunately, it wasn't about membership because there's always been a tremendous demand for membership. But then my stress really became about operations, running the place smoothly. You know, we brought a lot of the staff over from the Sunset Tower, but it's very hard to just open up a hotel and a restaurant and, yeah, the food's perfect, the service perfect. Now it is, I think, but it's been stressful. So, It's always something.
It would have been nigh impossible had you not the experience, relationships, people that you could draw from the Sunset Tower.
For customers, you mean, or for employees?
Employees and yeah. operations.
Which is what we did.
Yeah, it would have been very, very difficult, I'm hearing. So what was the community like when you started? Did you have to promote it? Did you have to, I mean, when I observed it today, it felt very lively, but was it always that way or did you have to grow it?
We had to grow it. It's still growing. It's not at near capacity. We're growing it slowly and correctly. And so we right now we have about 1,200 members. And I think there's a little over 8,000 applications because we don't take every... I actually have nothing to do with membership. There's a committee of about 14 people from different walks of life that sort of just... They read all the applications and decide it. They're all members themselves, so it's a body of peers. And they're tough, you know, but which I think is good because you don't want to just sort of take anybody that applies and otherwise it doesn't feel so fun to be a part of it.
Part of what you were saying earlier is this was a means, the place was a means to the group, to the connection among people. And so the whole point is to find a sense of people that you want to intermix and
right.
connect with.
That's right.
Yeah. Can you say anything about the business model? It sounds as a club like it's relatively unique in the way it operates.
Well, it is unique. I would say that, from a business point of view, the membership revenue is extremely important, which is where I can make a living, which is, different from a normal hospitality project because you don't have that revenue. But you still have, in theory, the food and beverage revenue and profits and the hotel profits as well.
Does it give you a different kind of cost structure as well?
Right now, the dust is still settling with everything. It shouldn't, and it won't ultimately, no.
And it's on track the way you want it to be?
Yeah, it is.
Great. We talked a bit about financing and location. Tell us about design. It seems like it comes largely from your own creative imagination. Is it from any particular set of references? Are there people you worked with that helped you round out the creative vision?
Well, the team was really important. Mark Appleton was the architect. He had restored the San Ysidro Ranch in Santa Barbara, and which is in a funny way a similar place. San Vicente is like a more urban version of it. It's more, it's not as spread out on 14 acres, but the bungalows are similar and the gardens are, so he played a fantastic role in it. And then the designer from London is a woman named Rita Koenig, who, what's weird is her mother designed the original Annabelle's in London in the 80s. Her mother was also a designer. So
itself an important private club.
Exactly. Probably the most important, I'd say, original place. Now it's been redone and it has a different feeling to it. But Rita, as the decorator, did a fantastic job. What she did was she sort of brought her knowledge of English, British, private clubs, which I think was important. And then she sort of slapped on her fantasy of what Hollywood and Beverly Hills should be. And as we know, fantasy is always more powerful than reality. And, Ralph Lauren, for example, it's his fantasy of what English clothing should be, which is actually better than English clothing. And I think Rita's fantasy of L.A. is better than the real L.A. It feels very L.A., but, it's...
In terms of construction, who'd you hire? How'd they do? Had you worked with them before?
Well, we interviewed a lot of people. We hired Artie Olson as the contractor. They did pretty well. I mean, nothing's perfect, but I recommend them to people, which is a great sign. And usually people say, I can't believe you're recommending a contractor. I've never heard of anybody who recommends a contractor because it's always such a nightmare. But we had a really great experience. There were a couple of hiccups, but they were on time, pretty much on budget. They made some mistakes, but they fixed them for the most part. There's still one outstanding mistake, but... I think they're going to fix it.
How did you find them? And, were there interesting moments along the way?
Not really. Nothing interesting.
Good.
I mean, it was just, headaches. I mean, Edison had to move a pole and that was delayed the job. They the day that they were supposed to move it, there was like a little drizzle and they wouldn't, you know, I mean, it was just like all those sort of nightmares that you hear about. They were referred to me, I don't remember who, but we vetted them out, and Mark Appleton, I believe, had also done some work with them. And I called, you know, I like to call clients and ask, you know, what their experience is like. And they got a pretty good report card.
We talked a bit about the market, which in this case are primarily the members, and you, how you started the group and how you've grown and curated the group. Sound that the community is going in the right direction. Is there anything you would do either differently or you're refining or doing new as it grows?
No, I think we're learning as we go along. But one thing that also is making, I think we're sort of unique in this club space, is we're extremely focused on making it a diverse crew of people. So we don't want it to be all, you know, I don't know, white guys over 40 in Hollywood. You know, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with white guys in Hollywood over 40, but like we want it to be diverse in every way, occupation, male, female, African-American, music, tech. The committee's really focused on that. And I think that that's the secret to our success, really. Because, you know, you don't want to, you know, Steven Spielberg, it's not exciting for him to sit next to Jerry Bruckheimer. I mean, he knows Jerry and it's like whatever. But if he sits next to a beautiful young fashion designer and he goes home and tells his daughter that, you know, he sat next to so-and-so, he'll think that's cool and she'll think that's cool and it's new and it's exciting and, you know.
Well, it sounds like in a relatively short period of time, you did something new that hadn't been here before by any means, and you got through many challenges to get there. How did it become a success for you, and how do you define that?
Well, I'm not successful, and neither is the place yet. So I don't know how I define it. I don't even think the Sunset Tower is success. I mean,
is that just modesty?
No, I mean, I guess success is like the day that like I sell everything, and you know, but it's just, it's not successful because there's always faults that I'm finding. You know, at lunch here today, I took all these notes, housekeeping notes, service notes from my waiter. There was a light bulb out in the bathroom. You know, that, to me, that's unsuccessful, and it will never be. I mean, which is why I love it. It's like a, you know, Greek myth. Nothing really interesting, or so, I mean, there was a lot of roadblocks, you know, constantly, like financing, construction, which were unfortunate surprises. You know, we had spent a lot of money and time trying to get EB-5 financing, which is, I'm sure everybody who's listening to this knows what that is, but it was a way to get around convincing a lender to believe in this product, because it was mostly Chinese people at the time that were trying to buy their green cards by investing in an American business, which was perfectly legal. I'm glad we didn't do it. A lot of people have since gotten into a lot of trouble with EB-5, because if it's not 100%, you know, correct, they, and I'm not even sure if they still do it, but the, you know, there was that surprise. And then, you know, there were roadblocks with construction, like I said, with Edison taking its time, and we had to, you know, repave the sidewalk. It was like a nightmare, the city requirements, and, you know, just everything was just very, there was a lot of difficult things and surprises. But in general, I'd say it was pretty smooth.
Was it what you expected or wanted?
Well, it's not what I want. I mean, what I'd want is to snap my fingers and everything's done the, you know, same day and perfect and exactly how I want it. But
result became pretty close?
The result became, there's some things that are unseeable, like the venting in the kitchen that, it's not the venting, I'm sorry, it's the air conditioning in the kitchen. It wasn't installed correctly. So there, you know, there are things like that. But for the most part, the physical property, the aesthetics, are, which is what attracts the customers, you know, from a development point of view. And then there's the sort of metaphysical piece of it, like, you know, the menu and the service and the way servers talk to people there and whatnot, welcome you. And so I'm happy with all of that, yeah.
Well, what do you like most about it and least?
I love the sense of being taken away when you enter that place. You certainly feel like you're entering a new world. And it's each time it's powerful still. I go there every day and, you know, it's very, very powerful. I'd just say the headaches of running the business, you know, turnover and waiters not knowing their job correctly or bussers bringing an appetizer to a table that's eating dessert, you know, things like that.
Well, what do you want others to notice or appreciate when they encounter it?
You know, everybody gets something different out of that place. So I don't think it's up to me to decide what I want them to get out of it. But, you know, some people love the garden. Some people love there's a, you know, really cool bar room. Some people love the screening room. You know, it's just everybody has their own special thing about that place.
Well, have you learned anything or drawn any conclusions about what you would do going forward with either this or whatever might come next?
I learned to listen to the place. I mean, it's always been the property that, I mean, it sounds corny, but that speaks to me. So I listen to the property. I'm not, you know, I don't want to, the same way all the other developers were trying to buy the Argyle and make it a trendy hotel, they were trying to slap that recipe onto it. I know not to do that. And when I first opened the San Vicente, everybody's like, this is so not your brand, but it's just that their minds were not open. I don't have a brand. I mean, it's not like, you know, I have the Sunset Tower. So yeah, it's very different than the Sunset Tower. But the reason it's so different is because it's about the property itself that dictated what it wanted to be. I'm just the sort of, you know, custodian, I guess, who's helping it get there.
Perhaps whether City Club or Sunset Tower or San Vicente Bungalows, you find a place, decide what it ought to be in its best form, then work to make it that, and then turn that into a business.
I try, yeah.
Do you have any particular models or goals for your general development strategy?
No, because as I said, I'm really a developer by accident, and that's not, you know, I mean, again, I have to find something that makes sense financially, which is hard, and I always say, like, I have to see ghosts, because if I didn't see ghosts in the Sunset Tower or in the San Vicente, you know, both of those properties, if people saw in it what I saw in it, I think they would have paid a lot more for it. So I am forced to see that.
Do you have any personal business philosophy to share of any sort?
I don't. I'm sorry.
What about anecdotes or motivation or lessons or insight or advice that you picked up?
I don't have that much. I mean, it's been pretty straightforward for me. Patience is a great quality to have in development. Waiting stuff out is important, is what I would say. That would be my advice.
What work by others do you admire?
I very much admire a hotelier in New York named Sean McPherson. He owns the Bowery, and he owns this, like, the Crow's Nest in Montauk, and he has this cool, like, surf hotel, and I think I don't even remember where it is, but in South America somewhere. And he's just an interesting, cool guy and does great projects. And he also, I think, listens to the soul of the place. I like Andre Balazs a lot, what he does. I'm not exactly my thing, but for the most part, I like it. There was a hotel liaison in London, Anushka Hempel. She's no longer in the business, but I liked what she used to do. You know, I admire a lot of people for different reasons.
What would you like to do that you haven't done yet?
What would I like to do as far as business or just in general? I'd probably love to open a San Vicente in Santa Monica, or on the west side, find a really special location.
We'd love to have you out there.
Maybe with an ocean view.
Love it. Anything else we ought to know?
I don't think so. Anything else you would like to ask?
No, I think you said quite a lot, and we really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing yourself, your vision, your story, your insight, and your creative energy with us.
Thanks.
We appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing how the San Vicente Bungalows thrive and watching what you and your company do next.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This episode of Positive Development was engineered by Adam Reynolds at Lamberger Productions in Hollywood.
Editing by Aaron Berman. Music by Mickey Petralia. Artwork by Greg Foley. And produced by your host, Gregory McKnight. Thank you for listening.